John Mortimer presents The Trials of Marshal Faulk. True stories from the archives of Britain's most celebrated criminal barrister, starring Tom Baker as Sir Edward Marshal Faulk. The Camden Town Murder. Introduced by John Mortimer.
Long before Camden Town became the home of trendy politicians and media couples on the way up, before it had coloured front doors and window boxes and pine kitchens, it was an even more dubious neighbourhood.
Oh, sit anywhere. Oh, do you like music? Oh, I love it. Music for me is like a sort of path. Only your feet need never touch the ground. That made you look at me, didn't it? What are you thinking? I ain't mad, I just feel things. I can't help it. Don't say much. Yeah. What are you doing? What do you want? No, don't hurt me!
Dawn in Camden Town. The light seeps through the thin curtains onto the lifeless body of Emily Dimmock. Elsewhere in London, another young woman, Ruby Young, has a particular interest in the front page story.
A young woman named Emily Dimmock has been found at her home in St Paul's Road, Camden. Her throat had been cut. Police found a letter and a postcard near the body and are anxious to trace their author. Do you recognise the hand?
Oh, Bob!
Ruby, I'm in trouble.
It's your writing they found on this postcard.
Now, have patience with me.
What on earth have you done?
Shh. Listen, believe me, I've done nothing wrong. Let me explain. Last Friday, I was along the Euston Road. I decided to go for a drink. I'd never been there before, but I went into a public house, a place called the Rising Sun. Now, a girl came up to me. I didn't know her. She wanted money.
Here, have you got any change for the music, mister?
Hey, hold on.
I've come out without any. I'm forgetful. I live in a drain.
Here.
Oh, thank you. I love to hear music. You couldn't buy me a drink as well, could you?
All right, what do you want?
Brandy. Are you on your own?
We chatted. Just chat. She seemed pleasant enough.
The paper said she was on the game.
A young boy came in selling postcards. They were inartistic. I told her I was an artist and I had some postcards in my pocket. I'd just come back from Bruges. I gave her one of those.
Oh, well, write me a nice message on it, won't you?
What? What should I write?
Oh, well, say we'll meet here again.
Mm-hmm.
Something nice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. There.
Oh, and you've done me a drawing too. Oh, you're talented, I can tell.
Mm.
You're going to get me another drink?
Well, I told her I'd post it to her, but I had no stamp. I probably have forgotten it, but the next day I saw her, just by chance, in New College Street, on my way to the gas company. She said, "Have you posted me that card yet?" So I posted it that night. I saw her again on the Monday, in the Rising Sun. I don't know why I went back there. Oh, Ruby, dear, I wish I hadn't.
We know your little weaknesses, Bob.
I saw her there. She was talking to a man, a lame fellow. She came up to me. She said she was frightened of him. Anyway, we talked for a bit and then we left together.
I see. A leopard doesn't change its spots.
Hey, I mean we both had to leave at the same time. That's all. I walked a little way with her up Seymour Street. There was a group of horsey-looking men on the corner. They called to her. She went over to them. I went home. That's the last time I saw her. On Tuesday night, I saw my brother.
And she was killed the next night.
That's the problem, old girl. I was alone. I went for a walk, but there was no one with me. That's why I need you to say you saw me on the Wednesday.
Go to the police, Bob.
What?
Tell them what you've told me. Tell them how you met her, how you came to write the card and where you were on Wednesday. Then you'll be free.
I can't do that. Ruby, I can't. My father is very ill. God, if he even knew I'd gone somewhere like the Rising Sun, do you see? I fear it would hurt him too much. Ruby, please. Help me.
And she agrees. Lovers have frequently provided alibis for each other, though a promise once made can become a burden. One evening, to their meeting in Piccadilly Circus, Ruby does not come alone.
What is it? Don't look worried.
No, I know.
You will be true to me, won't you? I can't stop asking you.
I said I would.
Promise me?
I have promised. I can't stay tonight.
I've got tickets for a show.
What?
You still like shows, don't you? Ruby, you see that man?
No.
I think he's a policeman.
No, I don't think so. Here's a kiss.
What was that for?
Mr. Wood?
Yes?
Inspector Neil from Highgate Police Station. Can we go somewhere to talk?
Certainly.
Arthur Newton pauses on the steps of Three Temple Gardens. Engaged by Robert Wood to act as his solicitor, Newton has wasted no time in deciding to enlist the services of Mr. Marshall Hall. In the famous chambers, Marshall Hall's clerk, Mostyn, is receiving instruction in some of the lesser-known tactics in the art of advocacy.
No, Mostyn, how many times must I tell you? First, the handkerchiefs.
The handkerchiefs, right, sir.
You bring the handkerchiefs out when I gesture thus.
You pinch your nose?
Yes, I gesture thus. I put my hand out like so.
I offer you a handkerchief from the pile.
And then?
You take one.
Yes, and then I do this, Mostyn.
To gain the attention of the jury.
To gain the attention of a jury, precisely. When my very good friend has just asked a wounding question of one of my witnesses. Good. Next.
The air cushion.
Oh, not yet, Mostyn. Not yet. We keep the big guns until last. Next, the carafe of water, which you place...
on the table in front of you.
Within reach.
Yes, sir.
In order that...
when your very good friend makes some good point or other...
I divert the jury's attention by...
knocking the carafe over.
Thus...
you just knocked the carafe over.
This is a rehearsal, Mostyn, but we must mean it. Finally...
Mr. Marshall Hall?
Newton, finally...
may I?
Not now, Newton,
there's
finally...
there's broken glass all over there.
What do you want, Newton?
I have a brief for you.
Ah. R versus Robert William Thomas Wood.
Do you know the case, sir?
A young girl, not exactly pretty, confident smile, dressed in a sailor costume in a photograph I saw, found in Camden Town, her throat cut.
Will you take it?
Of course.
You will?
Newton... this is the greatest case I've ever had in my life. He's innocent, yet a chance idea may mean life or death to him. Mostyn, clear this glass up, will you?
Marshall Hall's opponent at the Old Bailey is the diminutive figure of Sir Charles Matthews. Delicate of appearance and oily of manner, Matthews has the habit of placing his fingertips together before asking each question, as though in this precise act his words, too, will be guaranteed perfection.
Inspector Neil, I wonder whether you would be so good as to inform the court of the lamentable scene which greeted you on your arrival at No. 29 St. Paul's Road on the morning of September the 12th.
Yes, sir. On arriving there, I went into the bedroom. I saw a heap of clothes, first of all. The bed had a very disarranged appearance. The bolster was lying lengthways at the back of the figure lying on the bed. On removing the coverings, I saw the nude figure of a dead woman. The bedclothes were all saturated in blood. There was a stream of blood on the floor. The blood had gone through the bed. I then saw a cut in the throat, which was not visible at first because the chin was down towards the breast. It was an extensive cut, very deep. In fact, the head was almost severed from the trunk. I formed the opinion that the wound must have been caused by a very sharp instrument used with a very determined force.
Thank you. We are grateful to you. You examined the room?
Yes, sir. In the grate in the fireplace, I found a letter and an envelope, partly burnt. On a chair in the front room was a postcard album. On searching the drawers, I found another postcard.
This postcard?
Yes, sir.
Could you read what is written on the card, Inspector?
Darling, if it pleases you, meet me at 8:15 at the... there's a drawing of the rising sun. Yours to a cinder, Alice.
May I now draw your attention to the remaining scraps of burnt paper which you found in the fire grate? Was any of the writing on those papers still legible?
Legible, yes. But you can't really understand what they say.
Well, we shall try, Inspector. We shall endeavour to do just that. Could I ask you to decipher for us the letters that remain?
Mr. Marshall Hall, have you any objection?
No, my lord. I am as anxious as anyone to hear my learned friend's foray into the realms of speculation.
I am grateful to my learned friend. Inspector Neil, what were those letters again?
Will you, and the letters A.R.
Oh, they might be saying, might they not, will you meet me at the bar, then?
Of the town S.
Perhaps the name of a public house follows in or near Camden Town Station. And then?
Wednesday, good, fond, from. That's all, sir.
Wednesday, goodbye, fondest love, from. And what we have is an invitation, do we not? A request for an assignation which Emily Dimmock was to keep, and which was to be her last on earth. The question we are compelled to answer, who wrote it? Inspector Neil, have you compared the handwriting on the postcard and on the letter?
I have, sir.
And what is your opinion?
They are in the same hand.
You are saying that the postcard which the prisoner admits writing and the letter were written by the same person?
I am.
Thank you, Inspector.
Sir Charles places his small fingers together. His next witness is a large man in a dark suit who awaits his examination with a solemn, attentive expression.
You are Robert Henry McGowan, a baker of 2 Hawley Street, Chalk Farm Road.
I am.
Please tell the court where you were on the morning of Thursday, September the 12th.
I was on my way to work, sir, at the bread company in Brewery Road. I left home at 4:40 a.m, as usual, and went through St. Paul's Road. Just as I was passing 29 St. Paul's Road, I heard footsteps. I turned round. I saw a man leaving the gate of number 29.
What was he wearing?
He had on an overcoat, with the collar turned up, and a hard bowler hat.
Did you notice anything else about him?
It was the way he walked.
The way he walked?
Yes, sir. A sort of jerk in the way he walked. A sort of quick motion. The left hand was down by the side, the right shoulder coming round. A sort of quick jerk with his shoulder.
Were you asked to attend an identity parade at the police station?
Yes, sir.
And did you manage to identify anybody as being the man you saw leave 29 St. Paul's Road?
Yes, sir. It was him, sir. The prisoner.
Will you? Mr. Marshal Hall may have some questions.
Mr. McGowan, a man's life is at stake here.
I realize that, sir.
I tell you that because a witness who is swearing a man's life away must be accurate.
I have tried to be.
Yes, you think you have been. It was a drizzly morning, wasn't it, that Thursday? How would you describe it?
Drizzly, yes, sir.
Damp. Foggy?
Yes, sir.
Visibility poor, would you say?
Yes, sir. The street lamps were on.
The street lamps? Ah, yes. You couldn't have seen without the street lamps, could you?
Any fool knows that.
Quite. Now, you've told the court you left home at
4:40.
And that you passed 29 St. Paul's Road at 5 a.m.
Well, I heard the clock.
You heard the clock strike. That's right. Good. And you heard a noise.
Well, the gate closing.
And you turned, and you saw a man come out and walk away from you. Away from you. A man you were able to identify later as the prisoner.
Yes.
And you were able to make this identification because of the street lamp opposite burning on this foggy morning.
That's right.
I have here a lighting chart from the Electric Lighting Authority, which states, Mr. McGowan, that the current was switched off at 4:37 a.m. on the morning of Thursday, September the 12th.
It was on.
No. It wasn't. It was off.
Well done, sir.
Yes, but look at Wood.
Looks calm enough.
Too calm, Newton. I score a victory in his favour and not a blink from him. What do you think the jury would make of that?
He's a cold fish.
Call Ruby Young.
Cold enough to kill.
Miss Young, you are acquainted with the prisoner?
Yes.
In fact, you met him several times recently.
Yes, sir.
At his invitation.
Yes.
And each time you met, he asked you to make a promise.
Yes.
Could you tell the court what that promise was?
He said, he asked me to say, if anyone asked, that he was with me on Mondays and Wednesdays.
If someone asked?
Yes.
And he repeated it?
Yes. He kept saying, keep your word. Will you keep your word? On the last evening, he said, my word and your word will stand against the world. I told him that if my name got into the papers, it would hurt my mother. And he replied, if your name gets besmirched in any way, I will marry you if I get free. I told him I did not want to marry.
Have you ever walked behind the prisoner?
I have walked behind and beside the prisoner, yes.
How does he walk?
He has a walk that no one else can copy. With the left hand tight in his left pocket, he brings the right shoulder forward.
Would you say it is a noticeable walk?
Oh, yes. It is a walk quite distinct to him.
I do beg your pardon, my lord. I appear inadvertently to have knocked over my carafe. Miss Young, you have told us of a series of meetings with the prisoner. Would you be so good as to describe to the court your last meeting with him?
You want me to say it again?
Well, if you would.
I was worried. I went to the police. I was advised to do that.
By a friend?
By an acquaintance.
Tell the court, was this acquaintance a journalist?
I never sold my story.
No, no. But it's important to get the facts perfectly straight. Please go on.
Inspector Neal said that I was to attend the meeting with the prisoner to... And so that he would know it was him and not some other person. When we met, I...
Yes?
I was to kiss him.
Ah.
I always thought he would clear his name easily. Well, that's what I wanted.
Miss Young, did you at one time entertain hopes of marrying the prisoner?
For a time.
But it wasn't to be.
I broke off with him. He was seeing other women.
The prisoner asked you, did he not, to say that he was with you on the Wednesday evening. That is so, isn't it?
Yes.
The police doctor states that the deceased woman was murdered between 3 and 4 in the morning. Has it ever struck you that this was a perfectly useless alibi for the murderer, but a perfect alibi for meeting with the girl?
No.
The murderer would seek an alibi, would he not, for the night, for the early hours of the morning. Only an innocent man, ignorant of the time of the girl's death, but anxious to avoid the publicity of being associated with her at all, would seek an alibi for the evening. Would you not agree with me, Miss Young?
Yes.
Yes.
Colwood to testify?
Yes.
Have you considered the risk of that, sir? Have you spoken to him lately?
Why?
I think he's mad.
What?
Look, I'm not given to exaggerate, sir. All I say is this. Before you put him in the box, speak to him. Will you?
Tell me, Robert, how do you feel about appearing in your own defence?
I don't really mind, sir.
You need to understand that the prosecution will not spare you.
Well, that doesn't sound very nice.
The jury must be assured, must see that you are not the kind of person who would slay a defenceless girl. They must be reassured.
How could I do that?
By demonstrating that you have been foolish.
I admit to that.
Yes, but listen to me. They must not feel that you are hiding from them. Elusiveness is no virtue in the courtroom. You're smiling.
You have a talent for aphorisms, sir. Something I've always wanted myself.
Will you take this seriously? In just over 1 hour you will be in the witness box. Do you understand what that means?
Yes. Cheer up. I'm sure we'll be all right.
My God, you are right, Newton. The prosecution will destroy him. It'll make it seem that this feckless and deceitful young man led a double life, frequenting rough bars and associating with prostitutes. A life that sooner or later would naturally encompass a barbaric act of violence.
You'll leave him out then.
And if I do that, there's enough evidence to hang him. Nope. It's his only chance. We put him in. I call the prisoner Robert Wood. I'm going to ask you one question before I go into detail. Did you kill Emily Dimmock? I will ask you again. Did you kill Emily Dimmock?
Well, of course not. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I wish for a direct answer.
No.
I do not wish it to be said that I did not put the direct question. I put it. How long had you known Emily Dimmock?
Not long.
I beg you to be specific.
I met her 1 week before she died.
You met her by chance?
Oh, absolutely.
You found her attractive?
There was something about her which appealed to me, I would say.
What was that?
She was merry and bright. She impressed me as A crushed rose that had not lost all its fragrance and had been thrown aside.
Were you in love with her?
No.
But you liked her?
Oh, yes. She seemed a girl who might have seen better days, if you see what I mean. She had a sort of rough refinement.
Why did you seek to make an alibi?
Well, my father is ill. Very ill, you see. And well, I was much concerned to conceal that I frequent public houses. As for the rising sun, not wishing to hurt the feelings of the proprietor, the place hardly has a good name. When I saw the announcement in the newspaper and a copy of the postcard I'd sent to the girl, I made up my mind to try and induce Ruby Young to say falsely that I was with her that evening. Is it not natural that I should do so?
I wish now to turn to the charred remains of a letter. The writing is undoubtedly yours. Can you explain how it came to be half-destroyed in Emily Dimmock's room?
No. I never wrote to her making an appointment. I never sent this woman a letter through the post, only a postcard. I can't explain. I cannot explain how it came to be there.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Please, stay where you are.
So, I see. A letter which moves through the air, unencumbered, as it were, by human intentionality, issuing from a source we know not.
I'm just telling you the simple truth.
Ah, if only the truth were simple, we would not need to be here. But alas, we have only the facts with which we must wrestle. The facts. You sent the girl a card. An invitation to meet you.
It was hardly an invitation.
Darling, if it pleases you, meet me at 8:15. Yours to a cinder, Alice. You're telling the court. These words were not an invitation to meet.
Not exactly.
Then I confess I do not understand the English language. You made an appointment.
It was hardly an appointment. I don't make appointments.
You don't?
Hardly ever. I don't like to.
Why did you sign yourself Alice?
She told me to.
In a spirit of play?
Yes.
I see. You meet her for the first time. You send her a card which anyone else, including the recipient, would unequivocally understand to be an invitation. You call her darling. By the way, why did you do that?
Just to please her.
And then you follow the card up with a letter.
No.
In order to confirm an invitation you had already made by postcard. You were eager to meet her.
Well, it's easy to write a story round the words in it. It is imagination only.
Let me put it to you directly. Were you in Emily Dimmock's room on the night of her murder? Would you answer?
It is only to you, Sir Charles, that I should answer that question. I should be indignant with the average man.
Answer!
No!
Sir, how do you think he did?
Disastrous. Don't you think? Why does he have to appear so studiedly nonchalant? It could hang him.
So what's left to you, sir?
My final speech, that's all. And would you believe me, Mostyn, I have no idea what I'm going to say to them.
Well, surely, sir, you'll think of something. Won't you?
Gentlemen, I believe there is no case to answer. What is the evidence of murder? The only iota of evidence against the man is that of the baker who began, you recall, by a description of a stranger seen from the back in fog without the aid of electric lighting. Consider his words. If any one of you gentlemen had a poor, suffering animal to kill, and whether you killed it or not depended on his evidence, would you kill it? I would now pass to Miss Ruby Young. I would gladly have said nothing of her. I would have let her go from the witness box, poor, unfortunate, wretched woman, who has no doubt experienced many a moment of mad remorse for her part in the case, but for one thing. The evidence of the baker stood alone in its glaring improbability till December the 4th, when, 2 months after the arrest of her lover, Ruby Young for the first time said he had a peculiar gait similar to that described by the baker. That statement, gentlemen, it pains me to tell you, was invented out of revenge for the suggestion that her calling was the calling which in fact it was. The prisoner has stated that she was a prostitute. So far as she was concerned, it was a gross and vindictive lie. You cannot hang a man on evidence such as that. I defy you to do it. I defy you. I do not merely ask for a verdict of not guilty. I demand it.
The jury is back in 15 minutes.
How do you find the prisoner? Guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
The handkerchief worked well, sir?
Yes.
And the carafe of water?
Yes. But where was the coup de grace?
Coup de what, sir?
The air cushion during that last examination of Matthews when he was cutting my witness to pieces. Where was the air cushion?
I didn't know about the air cushion.
If any moment called for the air cushion to be noisily inflated, it was then, wouldn't you say?
Well, I suppose so.
Inflated now.
Now?
Yes. Flow, Mostyn, blow.
Marshall Hall has saved his client's life. It's a debt Wood freely acknowledges when he considers how near he's come to the gallows. My reaction cannot be conveyed in words, he writes, and my thanks to Mr. Hall can never be expressed. Marshall Hall's next notorious murder case, The Hint of Arsenic, also turned on the appearance of a single witness.
John Mortimer presented The Trials of Marshall Hall, dramatised by Michael Butt and directed by John Taylor, with Tom Baker as Sir Edward Marshall Hall, and featuring Nicholas Farr, David Glover, Timothy Block, Jonathan Tafler and Kelly Bright. The Trials of Marshall Hall is a Fiction Factory production for Radio 2.